WXCO 1230 AM, W255DN Wausau. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. If you or someone you know is down for the count with a fever and chills, CBS's Alexander Tin reports.
CDC data suggests this winter's second wave of influenza infections is now at some of the highest levels on record since late 2009, amid that year's swine flu pandemic.
Close to 8% of visits for respiratory illness to outpatient providers reported to the CDC this week were people sick with influenza. The Coast Guard has located the wreckage of a commuter plane on sea ice near Nome, Alaska. KTUU-TV's Tracy Sinclair.
9 people and the pilot were aboard that plane when it went missing yesterday.
Governor Mike Dunleavy says he's heartbroken by the loss of the 10 people on the Bering Air flight. After targeting the Treasury and USAID, President Trump says Elon Musk's team at Doge will review just about every federal agency, including...
He will be looking at education pretty quickly, and he will be looking at military, too.
CBS News Brief. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
I'm Brittany Merlot with WXCO News, your news roundup in a quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WXCO website at BullFallsRadio.com.
The Bucks take on the Hawks. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks are back in action tonight on the road against the Hawks. Milwaukee able to snap a 4-game losing streak with a win in Charlotte Wednesday, even though Giannis Antetokounmpo was out with a sore calf muscle. Head coach Doc Rivers.
Yeah, just, you know, we needed a win. I don't think anybody was that concerned by it, but no one likes losing, I can tell you that. And so getting a win, going to Atlanta, you know, hopefully having Giannis back, and you know, let's see what we have from there.
The Bucks confirmed that their mega trade sending Chris Middleton to the last place Wizards has been approved by the NBA, the team adding Kyle Kuzma from Washington and center Jericho Sims from the Knicks. Marjon Beauchamp was sent to the Clippers in exchange for guard Kevin Porter Jr. In college hoops, Wisconsin takes on Iowa at the Carver Hawkway Arena in Iowa City tomorrow, game time at 12 noon. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Imagine home. The smell of coffee, the sound of a lawnmower, the sun's warmth on your face. Free to be yourself, surrounded by love that helps you grow. This is a place to call home. That's an American dream we all deserve. But in 50% of U.S. states, you could legally be denied housing if you are LGBTQ+. Get the facts and hear real stories at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO, home of the Chad Holmes Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Boy, what a week we've had. So I guess we're occupying Gaza now, and we're going to end aid to the rest of the world because it costs too much. And we're not going to rebuild L.A., and we're going to slash and burn all of our foreign aid budgets, which is about 1% of the budget, and we're going to let China fill the void, but we're going to occupy Gaza. And I guess, you know, the big one, I guess... the 99-cent eggs we were promised, I guess that's not going to happen. And the reason I know it's not going to happen is Waffle House. Waffle House, as we speak, has added a surcharge on any customer ordering eggs. You want an egg? Another half a buck. You want 2 eggs? Well, a buck. Now, remember, we were told 99 cents a dozen. I guess not. And this is, look, Waffle House is no small player. They got 2,100 locations across the country. They serve 272 million eggs a year. That's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. And that's not even the money that, you know, you are going to spend on the increased cost of pancakes and everything else. Because guess what? There's eggs in there too. Now, the thing that's interesting to me is, where are my red hats? Where are the people screaming about the price of eggs? Gas prices are going up. The economy is not doing great. In fact, more layoffs this month. So what are we getting? Well, I think we've got a Trump with Musk on the brain. because Musk is, well, evidently his team of go-getters, a couple of teenagers with, you know, with nothing better to do, evidently they are feeding all of the data that they're gathering from all of our agencies into AI. So understand when Trump vowed to computerize the system for air traffic controllers, you know, he said, you know, we're not going to, you know, piecemeal it. We're not going to, how do you say it? You know, we're going to piece it together with obsolete things. We're brand new stuff. He means AI. He means we're going to replace people. Why? Musk on the brain. And that's not just going to be at the air traffic controller level. You know, just recently in my neck of the woods, one of the big health insurers laid off a bunch of employees because, well, we don't need them. We got AI to do these jobs. A couple hundred people are going to lose their jobs because, well, AI. And there's no AI adjustment program, is there? No. When we would do bad trade deals, at least we would pretend like we cared about workers and had a trade adjustment system that said, you know, if you lost your job because of trade, we'll let you go to community college for a while, give you a little extra unemployment, you know, make it look like we're trying. There's nothing, and there's nobody even suggesting it. And what you've got is you've got Musk ferreting his way into every agency in this country. And now Trump talking about firing thousands of health workers across the country, you know, thousands of people who work for the Department of Health and Human Services, you know, the people who are at the Food and Drug Administration, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, all of these health agencies, evidently a new order, new executive order. They're going to have to across the board cuts, slash and burn, get rid of these people. And oh, pray tell, how are they going to make this tough cut? How are they going to choose who should go and who should stay on the government island? Well, evidently, there are federal employees who claim that they've found a program that's been downloaded into the government computers that sifts through all of the team chats and all of the emails and stuff that workers put out, and they're going to look for, you know it, you know what's coming, because I've been telling you, we're making patronage great again. Anyone who has progressive thinking or is disloyal, if you're not a red hat full blown, not just a part-time Trumper, no, you got to have the hat and the shirt and a flag. Anything less than that, you're out. And understand, what we're doing is we're shrinking the size of government, and it's going to have a massive ripple effect. By summertime, I'm expecting thousands of layoffs. I'm expecting a whole bunch of red hats to be losing their minds. For instance, farmers. Farmers are about ready to lose their mind because this assault on the USAID, you know, the organization that we help pretend like we care about the rest of the world, and we throw them some crumbs. Evidently, it's left in limbo. They want to destroy it. And understand, it's not just about the workers they're going to screw over. It's about the food programs and the disaster relief and the health programs in 100 countries. And yeah, it's about condoms to ensure that diseases don't spread in those countries. They're destroying that. They're dismantling the whole thing. And again, who's going to step in and fill the void? It's going to be China. Our leadership is being diminished every day by this greed thinking. Because understand, Elon Musk doesn't care about this country. He cares about what he can get out of it. He cares about what he can mine out of it. His family, they're a family of miners. Now, it's not like they were down there with an axe and dynamite. They were shoving poor people in those holes. Musk knows where the gold is, and the gold mine is all of the information that he just stole. I'm sorry, that's the wrong way of framing it. I don't want to get sued for being absolutely incorrect. I mean, he took it. He's got it. But the Trump administration said, yeah, go ahead. And that's going to have a reverberation effect on all of us. And the assault on the Department of Health and Human Services just mind-blowing. But you've got still some of my Red Hat friends who are cheering it on. Yay! Screw those people over so that the next virus that comes, we won't know. And maybe there's something blissful in ignorance. Maybe there's something that makes us feel better when, oh, we just got hit by something. Don't know what it is. Don't know how to stop it. Oops. Yeah. We got a long way to go, folks. And I know the Democrats are putting up the show and trying to do something. It's got to come back to you and me, us. We have got to get active, engaged, in the streets, ready to shut things down. Or, you know, keep paying 50 cents an egg at Waffle House. And that will trickle down. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Wednesday, you had members of AFSCME and AFGE and unions from across the spectrum in D.C. rallying outside of the Department of Labor building saying, hey, no, how about we don't give Elon Musk and the DOGE committee all of the information from the Department of Labor? And a court on Thursday temporarily blocked that from happening. So as of right now, temporary order blocking the Labor Department from sharing any data with Musk and the little Doge boys after AFGE and others sued in court. And this is, again, another reason why labor unions are front and center in the attack, in the attack mode. And here to share some thoughts on, you know, what's going on. Because, look, we're seeing a lot of stuff. You got Andy Biggs, the congressman from Arizona, saying, hey, let's get rid of OSHA. Let's have a bill called NOSHA. Here to share some thoughts on what world look like if we had NOSHA. I've asked Stephen Farner to come talk with us. Stephen is LIUNA's International Vice President, the Laborers International Union of North America. He's also regional manager of Ohio, the Ohio Valley and Southern States region. Stephen, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
So we see this kind of chaos. We see this kind of these attacks on what has been decided law for decades, like going after OSHA, like burrowing into our data. In this first couple of weeks, what kind of gut reaction you got?
Well, chaos is certainly the word that keeps coming up in every conversation, right? That's the issue for workers, too. I mean, we have 25,000 federal employees. They're concerned. All these executive orders, everything that's coming out. And certainly as a construction union, OSHA is an important factor in what, you know, high road contractors operate in, right? I mean, the people who are following the rules are doing the right things. That's one thing. But all of those employers that aren't and putting workers at risk, I mean, the elimination of OSHA, it was a huge impact if something like that were to go through.
Now, what's interesting to me, Stephen, as I've had a number of your members and other construction union members reach out and go, no, that could never happen. And I go, maybe this bill, this moment right now couldn't happen, but defunding OSHA even further, as they've been doing for decades, that could really happen. And that could filter down to harming not just your members, but all workers in this country.
Absolutely. I mean, that's an old playbook, right? Kill something by not funding it. That would be the easiest way, probably. Who knows if that's the path that people go, but I think it's certainly worth considering. Yeah. I mean, some of these folks are going to put out 1,000 ideas, and if 100 of them are implemented, it could be disastrous.
Yeah,
it could hurt a lot of people.
Absolutely. You throw out 1,000 bad ideas, and if 100 of them stick, there's a lot to that. But, you know, here's my problem, right? Just the gut reaction that I have is I look at someone like Elon Musk, who is in the process, along with Jeff Bezos and Trader Joe's, pursuing a lawsuit to rule the National Labor Relations Act unconstitutional. A low-road employer, if you argue. I've heard some of the Amazon, the highest rates of injury in the industry. I've heard a lot of bad things about Tesla and the working conditions there. I don't know that I want a bad employer having all of the data and all of the controls of not just OSHA, but the entire Department of Labor.
It's scary to think about. The Department of Labor does many, many things, right, with a lot of the information they have. I mean, Elon Musk and folks, some of the companies you named, are subject to complaints. There's pending investigations, probably. There are information in those files that they'd be privy to, and you know they're likely privy to their competitors, to other businesses that are contained there. What would access to that mean, and how could it affect others? It's really, really concerning. I mean, it's personal information. They regulate labor unions. You know, OLMS keeps track of records on individual labor unions and officers like myself.
Right.
Yeah, how they might use that is should be concerning for people.
See, now during the campaign, you know, a lot of your members and a lot of especially building trades, a lot of my brothers and sisters in the Teamsters Union voted for Trump because they thought he was going to be pro business. That was going to help trickle down. It was going to give them better opportunities. None of them saw a getting rid of OSHA. None of them saw, you know, mining into the data of OSHA and other places and the Department of Labor of other places. Is this an opportunity to maybe go back and have those conversations of going, hey, look, during the campaign, we were looking for the other side. This is our guy. We need to start getting you to mobilize to push back against this stuff just to stop it. I mean, is this an opportunity?
100%. You know, I think General President Booker was on a week or so ago, and he made the point real clearly that what we want to do is inform our members, right? We want to put that information out there, good and bad. You know, if there's something done that's beneficial to our folks, to working people, glad to tell it. And certainly we want to hold people accountable for what their policies and actions do for workers. I mean, yeah. that's key to this, I think.
No, and look, good and bad, but there seem to be a lot of bad so far, because I always have people say, is there anything that you think he's done well? And let me throw that to you, because look, in 2017, had he come into office and said, I'm going to move on that $3 trillion investment package I talked about during the campaign, I'd have been right with him. Good on you. Let's go do that. Let's invest in this country. Let's get people back to work. Didn't do it. We're in that kind of position right now where I'm concerned that the little bit that we got during the Biden administration, the $1.2 trillion in investment, that they're going to start clawing back, and those jobs that were going to be the jobs of the next generation are all going to get wiped out. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I have the same concerns as you, but, you know, the thing about it is we will see it. I don't see it yet. I don't see tremendous clawback. But it could happen, and if it does, it'll resonate really quickly with workers. I mean, we have members working on chips plants, solar renewable energy projects, infrastructure projects, just all over the country that the Biden administration, funded and really accelerated these projects in this country. It would be extremely foolish to do anything to stop that, because that would result in immediate layoffs. I mean, once that turns off, people will be closing down jobs, and workers will know that because their paychecks stop with our folks.
But, you know, I keep getting this message, you know, from folks that, you know, we're going to create all these jobs, and it's going to be great. There's going to be all this stuff. Haven't told me how yet. But while they're undermining the ability of workers to organize, they fired Jennifer Bruzzo at the NLRB. The person that they put in is much, much worse. They fired someone at the National Labor Relations Board, basically neutering that board. We look at the moves that are being made, and it's really not good for workers, especially workers organizing. And I know you guys had a great year organizing last year. I know you guys are spending a lot of time and energy, boots on the ground, and a lot of energy around getting people together. But if that mechanism's broken, does it hamper your ability to organize?
Well, you know, honestly, the ability to organize has been hampered for a long time. We haven't been successful as it was, as would be anticipated, as we would hope under the current laws. So, I mean, that's a difficult thing to say, but right. It could get a lot worse. Get a lot worse.
And this is where I'm at, Stephen. I mean, it's a generational thing. I do believe. I think the younger generation, they get it. They've watched their parents get screwed over. They've watched their parents work 2, 3, 4 jobs to try and make ends meet. They've watched bad things happen because they don't have decent health care. And the younger generation wants change. It seems like the older generation's been trained like Pavlovian dogs to whenever they hear the word union, to repel. So for me, in these moments, it's an opportunity to reach people who may not have ever thought of unions in a positive light, to go, hey, look, these are the folks who are fighting for you to have a reasonable wage, good health security, good retirement security. I think this is a good opportunity.
Same. I agree. You know, the fundamental of organizing is reaching out to workers. I mean, it's talking to workers. And so far, this administration or any other can't stop us from doing that. So, right. You know, we need to do that work. We need to talk to workers. Union and non-union workers, and organize in the true sense, right? I mean, if we can get workers to stick together on any issue, then we can form agreements. We can bring employers to the table. We can do lots of things, and that's the NLRB process is helpful, but it's not the real strength of power.
Because I was going to ask you about this. I was going to ask you about, you know, the fact that, you know, there's the Supreme Court may decide at some point in the next year or two that the NLRA is unconstitutional, and they'll throw parts of it out, the parts that help workers. I probably assume that's what will happen. But anything that hampers your ability to organize, I'm sure will remain. But then you have to go back to, you know, the pre-NLRA thinking, because to me, the NLRA was a peace treaty. You know, the stories my grandfather's generation told me were of a country in turmoil. We were literally ripping the country apart brick by brick, having come back fighting fascism overseas to fight it here at home. Do you feel that it's going to take some kind of movement like that to get people to be more militant, I guess, in fighting for better wages, hours, conditions?
You know, I would hope not, but yeah. I kind of do think people are going to have to recognize that workers are going to have to recognize that all of these protections they thought they had, that it was just some kind of buoyancy that kind of maintained the status quo, and frankly they may not recognize the value of it until it's gone.
It's
a negative approach, but it's what I think. Yeah.
No, I'm with you. And this is why the reason I bring this up is I fear the only thing that reunites us is tragedy. I mean, you think of 9/11, you think of Pearl Harbor, you think of when bad things happen, the country comes together. And only in those moments of suffering and chaos do we find each other. And sadly, it comes back to the old labor frame of when your stomach's empty, your head gets right. And I fear that that's where we end. That's the only way forward. And I know organizers like you don't like to hear that, but that's kind of where my mind's at in this moment.
You won't find me disagreeing. Again, I'm, you know, I hope not that because here's the truth. A lot of people have to suffer to get to that point. There has to be a lot of hungry stomachs, you know, yeah. In a country as great as ours, that shouldn't have to happen. We, we have more resources. We have more jobs. We have more opportunity. We have more of everything than our grandparents, great grandparents ever thought to be possible, and yet we don't appreciate it. You mentioned the young people. I hope they're aware of that, and they're in tune with recognizing that that there are better opportunities that could be created, and that, you know, that aspiration can translate into organizing and reaching out to each other.
Yeah.
And finding that power that comes from workers sticking together.
No, look, I mean, my son's 18, my youngest daughter's 16. They're being called the tool belt generation. They're going to be the generation that are going to be tasked with rebuilding the mess that we've left behind. And, you know, the training process, at least for me, is getting them to think of, you know, the idea of solidarity and community and fighting for, you know, each other as much as they fight for themselves. So for me, this is an educational opportunity, not just for old guys like me and you, but for that next generation of workers like my kid.
Yeah, no, I agree. I have early 20-something kids, and you know, it's interesting to watch. They're passionate, they're engaged, they're listening, but there's so much information out there, and you know, cutting through the noise to get to real worker values. I think that's the task that we have. That's the challenge we have, because there's plenty of causes, you know. For kids to engage in out there, and they need to be focused on worker issues, because that's the core of this country.
No, you're absolutely right. No, we're the wealthiest country in the history of humanity at its wealthiest moment. We should be distributing things better. And this is where I think unions play a huge part, and where I think LIUNA and others play a huge part in being that stable voice that is, you know, on the path of, hey, we're going to build a more prosperous working class. We're going to make sure that people have health and retirement security. We're going to gain part of that American dream, instead of all of the nonsense that we see on social media and that our brains are just mushed with the constant drumbeat of nonsense. The hope is that unions pull us back together, because, you know, I saw a report the other day saying my kids' generation is going to be the first generation in humanity not to have face-to-face conversations, or not to be able to communicate face-to-face. This is where I think organizing, and especially in the workplace, brings us into that world.
Well, that's the number one initiative in the Laborers International Union. It's a program we call Laborers Rising, but it's essentially just talking to each other. Talking to our members, engaging them, you know, in communities and bringing them together to solve problems, and, you know, ultimately demonstrating the power that we have when we do that. And those are all face-to-face. You know, we do have social media components and all of that to share information, but the emphasis is on face-to-face communication. There's no substitute for that. And at some point, you know, I think people are hungry for it. You know, it's a human need, and I think it has value far beyond what can be generated. So,
especially on social media, look, because I think eventually in the next couple of years we're going to see it all collapse, because, you know, garbage in, garbage out. The only thing I find on social media these days is garbage. And when we finally wake up to that reality, it's going to be those organizations and institutions that stuck to their values and stuck to their beliefs, like a labor union, that I think people will turn to. Last question I've got for you. Obviously, there's a lot going on. We started talking about chaos. You know, what are you paying attention to as an international vice president there with the Laborers Union? What is it that you guys are focused on for your members? What are the warning signs, or what are the positives? What are you seeing?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, any drawback in the you know, in the federally funded programs, the IRA, the CHIPS Act, the infrastructure law, that will have immediate employment impacts for our members. Our benches will feel, you know, people be laid off. That's probably the biggest concern in the short run. You know, and that when that happens, I mean, people will be, you know, they'll be anxious. They won't have the paycheck to make the mortgage next month, or they won't be able to pay that truck payment, or, you know, it'll get real then. And then soon after, they'll lose health insurance coverage. And, so that's, you know, if I had to say my number one, you know, most pressing immediate concern, that would be it.
Yeah, I'm
plenty more down the road. But
I got to finish on, is there anything positive you're seeing? Because I know your members are going to hit me up and go, you're just talking about bad stuff. Anything positive out of this administration you've found yet?
You know, I don't know if I can directly attribute it to the administration, but certainly I'm in a meeting here today with pipeline contractors. You know, in the industry, the pipeline industry, which we have lots of members who work in, who build the infrastructure for transporting oil, gas, you know, petroleum products, they seem to be pretty positive. So, you know, they think there'll be lots of pipelines built and that, you know, we'll be building them. So we'll see.
We will see. It's something. It's something. So there you go. But Stephen Furner, I appreciate you taking some time for me. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as this administration continues down the road. But best of luck. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Furner, Liona's International Vice President, Regional Manager of the Ohio Valley and Southern States Regions. Want to hear your thoughts. What are you seeing on the ground? Anything got you excited? I know what's scaring you, but I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Winter weather advisory for 4 to 7 inches of snow starting late tonight and continuing on into Saturday afternoon. Low tonight in the mid-teens. High tomorrow, mid-20s. Sunday is looking mostly sunny. Highs only 15 to 20. Currently, it's 19 degrees.
Matt Nair on air.
Dan Schaefer, Civic Media's political editor.
No court in the country came closer to overturning the 2020 election results than the conservative majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And we have Brad Schimmel, who's been siding with January 6th rioters. So if you want your vote to count going forward, show up and vote on April 1st. Let's channel that energy into the Wisconsin Supreme Court race.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Ayo, way to go, Ohio, as Chrissy Hines said in one of the Pretenders songs. Again, taking it to education. You know what? Hey, we don't need a generation of educated workers. We need people just smart enough to push papers, do the work, but never smart enough to realize how bad we're getting screwed over. There was a comedian who said that not too long ago, but it seems to be true. And it seems to be what our Republican friends in Ohio continually try to do, which is destroy public education, now going after higher education. And oh, by the way, let's screw over workers and take labor rights away. So this Senate Bill 1, this is like the ultimate twofer. We get to go after labor and get to blank up education. And here to share some thoughts on what SB1 or Senate Bill 1 would bring us, I've asked David Jackson to come talk with us. David is the president of the Bowling Green State University Faculty Association. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to be here.
So how bad is Senate Bill 1? I mean, we've seen these education bills come up before. We've seen the attacks on workers' rights, on students, on funding, on privatization. We've seen all of this. What's the number one bill in the Senate, the first priority of the Republicans in the Ohio Senate? What's in this?
Yeah, so I'm the president of the Bowling Green State University Faculty Association. We are a collective bargaining chapter of the American Association of University Professors. We're also an affiliate of the American Federation of Teachers, and I'm here in that capacity and not in my capacity as an employee of BGSU, the university. So this particular piece of legislation is a comprehensively bad, multi-pronged attack on collective bargaining, higher education, academic freedom, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Basically a laundry list of things that have been beneficial for academic workers in Ohio. So on the public or on the collective bargaining side, one thing it does, for example, is prohibit any collective bargaining, any negotiations at all for the universities in Ohio who are unionized, and that's most of us, over any issues related to faculty evaluation. Any way in which the university would evaluate faculty employees would be a prohibited subject of bargaining. any way in which the university would decide that it needs to cut the workforce through a process called retrenchment would be a prohibited subject of collective bargaining. So what we find in terms of the attacks on collective bargaining is that what this bill would do is destroy our rights as unions to negotiate over something that is central as a term and condition of our employment, which is to say management, the administration, evaluating our performance, and of course, then not theoretically, but in reality, punishing us or disciplining us for poor performance. So that's just one of the places where it starts. The authors of the bill labor under a misperception that every faculty member is a liberal or a progressive who is trying to turn our students into liberals or progressives. And so some of the language in there says that students have to be allowed to form their own opinions about a certain set of controversial subjects. And we certainly support that. We certainly support the notion that students should be allowed to develop their own opinions about partisanship and matters like that. But for example, the bill says students must be able to form their own opinions on controversial subjects, including issues like electoral politics, which again, in the abstract and in the reality on the ground, in the way we currently do it, is a perfectly fine thing. But in a meeting with legislators about this bill, I brought up this hypothetical. What if a student said in my class, I believe that, or more to the point, put it on an exam answer, I believe that Elon Musk used his knowledge of computers to break into computers and steal the election for Donald Trump. I would have no choice, as I interpret and reasonable people interpret this law, but to accept that answer because that is the student forming their own opinion about matters related to electoral politics. Senate Democrats in Ohio have made a convincing case that the bill would require basically both sidesing the Holocaust, that students are allowed to come to their own opinions about things. And so that's just two examples of ways in which the law is troubling.
Right, but David, that's intellectual diversity.
Right.
they're in favor of diversity when it favors, you know, them.
Yeah, it's a strange form of intellectual diversity because what it doesn't seem to accept is that there are things that are factually correct and factually inaccurate.
Yeah, but those are your facts, David. Those are your facts. I've got my own. You've got yours. You shouldn't be correcting me. I mean, you are the teacher at all.
Yeah, and on that whole alternative facts thing, one of the conversations or issues that we have raised is supporters of the legislation will say, well, you know, the law would say that students have the right to raise controversial topics in the classroom, and that what the faculty members should do is to challenge those controversial ideas in the classroom. And I say, well, we're perfectly fine with that. That makes sense. But then the question becomes what happens after that? Because if this law is in place and it says that students have to have the right to come to their own conclusions, and I mark a student down for coming to a conclusion that is demonstrably factually inaccurate, a student or more troublingly, an organized interest behind a student could use this law to put a professor on complaint with the university, which would initiate conceivably something involving a discipline process. And then, of course, the faculty union would be involved.
So I got to ask the most glaring question to me, which is, how did the education system get turned on its head like this? You know, because, look, I don't think I'm that old. But it's been a while since I've been in a college classroom. And I remember, you know, bringing up controversial topics. I remember, because I was kind of a class clown, I remember making up nonsense to see what kind of a rise I would get out of the professor. And he usually dressed me down. And then the rest of the class usually ganged up on me and kind of brought me back into the middle of this. From what I understand, that's not how it's done anymore. Someone comes in with one of these crazy theories. We've got to now take it seriously. And if anyone, you know, infringes on their beliefs, it's everybody else's fault, not theirs for being, as you said, demonstrably wrong. How did we get here? That's my question. I get all these Senate bills. I get Republicans trying to defund and destroy and privatize. I get that. But how do we get to this place?
I think that there has been a concerted effort by one political party in the United States to criticize and demonize higher education, to scapegoat higher education for their perceptions about what's wrong in our society. And it's a really unfortunate thing that's happened, because we know that higher education is a major tool for social mobility. Here at BGSU, one of the groups of underrepresented students that we have a large number of are students who are first time in their family attending college. That group of students experiences a form of social mobility and life improvement from their experiences here that's unbelievable. It's incredible to be part of that process, making that happen. And so the last thing we're thinking about is trying to turn those students into anything in terms of ideology and partisanship, except for critical consumers of media, critical consumers of information, critical thinkers. So there's this disconnect that we feel in our daily jobs, where every single minute that we're here, we stress student success. We stress recruitment of students, retention of students, graduation of students, and the launching of successful lives as citizens and employees. And to have a political party so convinced that what we're doing is wrong and destructive is demoralizing, to say the least.
Yeah, but there you go with your elite talk again. You and your critical thinking and your education. You smart people think you know everything.
I was having a conversation online with somebody I don't even know, and of course that's what we do on social media a lot. And the person said, "Oh, you know, look at all these PhD professors who are against, you know, this bill. You guys don't live in the real world." And very politely, I wrote back to the person and said, "We live in the same world as you live in." And the person wrote back and was like, "Yeah, but I talked to repairmen and you guys are rude and condescending to them." And I was like, "Look, man, everybody has a different set of skills. And, you know, my dad was a millwright and my dad could change the oil in my car. I can't. So I pay a professional to do it."
Certainly.
And what we need is a return back to an acknowledgement on both sides, or all sides, or all groups of, you know, the different things that we bring to the table. I mean, I can do a few things around the house, but I really can't deal with electricity. I grew up around electricians, and even my dad, the millwright, thought electricians were like special
and
different.
It's like voodoo, yeah.
And I'm like, okay, yeah, I need an electrician. I'm not going to mess around with that. And right. It's like, let's get back to that and talk to each other about
that's that who critical we are and what thinking. We can do. That's that critical thinking there, that you going, "I don't know enough about it. I touch this and I touch that. It could be the end." That's that intellectual elitism right there playing itself out. Now, but you know, the reason I bring this up is that's kind of been the knock against college professors and against the college educated. Whereas I've got a degree. I don't use it. Maybe I do, but I look at education as something to help you solve problems in the future, help you to visualize and understand things a little bit differently, to be able to filter things better, maybe to not fall for every conspiracy theory and knee-jerk reaction that comes down the pike. So this is why I think, and this is my fear, and you can help me if I'm wrong here, my fear is this has become a red hat, blue hat issue, talking about education, based on more educated people seem to vote for Democrats, less educated people seem to vote for Republicans. I don't know why that is per se, but that just seems to see how it bleeds out. And this, again, seems like it's just a political hit job to go after people that we don't like who wear a different hat, instead of what's in the best interest of society and ultimately the state of Ohio.
Well, I mean, I run the risk of sounding partisan or ideological here, but during the press conference where the sponsor of SB1 spoke, the senator mentioned that Ohio is number 13 in the country in student debt default. And I say, boy, that's a real problem. That's something that should be done. There is nothing in this bill that would fix that.
Right.
And I would argue that if your party isn't offering solutions to problems, one tactic to take instead is to demonize some people, to divide people, and distract people from what we all have in common, like the person I was, you know, communicating with on Facebook, you know, recently. And I don't think it does us any benefit to be, you know, in that position. And
I agree.
I try not to see everything through partisan and ideological lines, but it doesn't take too many steps in the critical thinking process to say that if a party's not offering solutions, it has to offer up scapegoats.
It's offering problems. No, if you're not part of the solution, you're the problem. And this is this. So as I understand this bill, and I want to get back to what it does and what it doesn't do, because from what I understand, it effectively ends tenure, which means we're gonna end up with an education system in Ohio where you're gonna have basically adjuncts running everything. Not that that's not how it is close to now, but ultimately you're gonna have at-will part-time people teaching the next generation, and that's not great. It gives the administration the ability to shut down programs, from what I understand, just I guess at a whim. It mechanizes kind of what you do in the classroom, kind of turning you into factory workers. And also, it's got more than 100 unfunded mandates that, to your point about the you know, the student debt, seems to raise that cost of tuition that students might have to incur as well. It seems like a lot of bad here.
Yeah. So, for example, on the ability to close programs, it has some arbitrary threshold number of degrees offered over a certain number of years. And if a program doesn't reach that number of degrees, then that program should be eliminated. Well, that doesn't make any sense, because there's lots of places, lots of departments that don't offer many degrees, but offer tons and tons and tons of classes that students take for general education requirements. So you could stop offering the degree and you wouldn't save any money, because you would still need to offer those courses anyway. So that's another piece of the bill that's indicative of a lot of what's wrong with the bill, which is that stakeholders in public higher education in Ohio, and this only applies to the public higher education in Ohio, that we haven't been consulted and taken seriously in terms of making a contribution to it. In terms of the tenure question, yeah, it effectively destroys tenure, because what it does is say that any administrator can, if they can document it in any way, show what they perceive to be poor performance by a tenured faculty member, they can be put through a post-tenure review process that very quickly can result in the termination and detenuring of that faculty member. And I just want to mention the concept of tenure here. Tenure does not mean a job for life. Tenure is an expectation of reemployment and a due process system if an administrator believes that a tenured faculty member is not performing and needs to be replaced. So the purpose of tenure, as it was created when the American Association of University Professors was created back in 1915, I believe, was to protect academic freedom. Because people at universities back then, and sometimes today, were being fired because they were critical of companies owned by members of boards of trustees. And so the purpose of tenure is the protection of academic freedom. And here at Bowling Green, we have multiple classes of faculty. So there's tenured faculty, and then there's full-time non-tenure eligible faculty. And those faculty have full-time jobs and full-time salaries and benefits, but they're not protected by tenure.
Right.
And that's 35 to 40%. And then there's an even less protected group that you mentioned earlier called adjuncts, which is to say part-time faculty members who are taught on a per-course basis with no benefits and no protections whatsoever. And so we need to do a better job within our profession of explaining to the public why tenure is important, explaining to the public why it's not a job for life, and explaining to the public, especially this fact, that higher education in the U.S. takes place at places like Bowling Green State University, community colleges. Every time there's some expose of higher education, It's about something going on at Harvard or something going on at the University of Michigan, which are great places and important places and maybe set trends and things like that. But the vast majority of students, even in the state of Michigan, are not being educated at the University of Michigan. They are being educated at Central Michigan, Eastern Michigan, Wayne State University, Michigan State University, community colleges. Same thing here in Ohio. We love Ohio State, but they're not the majority. what we need for the public to recognize that the work that we do is not done through an ideological or partisan lens. We are helping young people develop the skills they need to experience beneficial and successful lives that include social mobility.
There you go. Last question I've got for you, because, you know, I look at this and obviously we're in a moment. We've got a guy in the White House who seems fixated on DEI. Ultimately, isn't this bill really about just ending diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at the university level? Isn't that really the aim? Isn't that the blinder? Isn't that what they're selling?
Yeah, I mean, it bans diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. It doesn't do a particularly clear job at all of defining what those mean. And so a colleague of mine wrote a pretty interesting analysis that said, could scholarships that are offered to first-generation college students be allowed under this? That would really affect our university, since that's singling out a group of students for a benefit. It turns out we have a scholarship here for, I think, as he pointed out, it's a Christopher Columbus scholarship, essentially, for Italian-American students. Could those things be offered? So DEI is, you know, this set
boogeyman.
Of capital.
It's the boogeyman.
Yeah, that's exactly the word. I was going to say a lot more words to make that point.
No, please do. Please educate me, because boogeyman is the only one my truck driver mind could think of. Please.
It becomes all things to all people who want something bad. So anything I don't like is DEI. Yeah. And, you know, at BGSU and lots of other places where the vast majority of people are educated in Ohio, what DEI is inclusion, is student success. It's finding students, taking students where they are in life and providing them the means to get through a college education and become successful.
Well, let's hope this gets shot down. Let's hope that the folks of Ohio wake up, and everyone around the country who has a Republican legislator, maybe wait for this bill. Because I know in Pennsylvania, the professors in this state have been fighting a lot of these same battles. So this isn't just isolated to my home state of Ohio. But David, I appreciate you taking some time, sharing some thoughts on this. And as this horrible thing moves along, I'd love to talk to you again.
Thank you very much.
David Jackson, president of the Bowling Green State University Faculty Association. I want to hear your thoughts. Good idea? Should we just destroy higher education altogether? Who needs it? Who needs it? Email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2008. That evening at 7:15 p.m., an explosion rocked the city of Wentworth, just outside Savannah, Georgia. An explosion had gone off at Imperial Sugar. Highly combustible sugar dust had ignited. 8 people died at the scene, while later, 6 more workers succumbed to their injuries at a regional burn center. The explosion left dozens more injured. The sugar refinery and packaging plant had operated since 1970. It was one of the largest refineries in the United States. The company had been warned for decades about the dangers of sugar dust. Yet the dust collection system was undersized and in disrepair. The building materials at the plant were outdated and added fuel to the fire. Worse, as many as 40 workers were not trained on how to evacuate in an emergency. Once the fire started, it burned quickly. The inferno reached temperatures of 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The Chemical Safety Board investigated the accident. Their conclusion was that it was entirely preventable and the deaths and injuries should not have happened. OSHA introduced a bill to regulate the dangers of combustible dust. But the Combustible Dust Explosion and Fire Prevention Act of 2008 did not make it through Congress. The company settled a series of civil lawsuits and paid a $6 million fine for the safety violations at Wentworth and another one of its plants. But they admitted no wrongdoing in the disaster. By November 2009, Imperial had rebuilt at the site. the disaster at Imperial was not an isolated incident. In the 3 decades leading up to that accident, 300 dust explosions killed more than 120 workers at sugar plants, food processing plants, and grain silos across the nation.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Let's get ready to bumble. That's right. We're going to bumble. We're going to bumble. And I can't wait to see the hearing with Linda McMahon. Set for confirmation hearing coming. And we all know what we're going to hear. How much she cares about children. Cares about education. How much she's going to fight for children. And yet, the right-wing echo chamber, I keep hearing in their voice that their panties are all in a tingle. The prospect of her destroying and dismantling public education and the very agency that she will head, the Department of Education, makes them very, very happy. We're going to hear a lot about school choice, a lot of choice. We love choice, you know, between bad choice and worse choice, or just worse choice, which is what we keep getting. And I don't know that we'll hear a lot about charters. I'm not sure. I think the charter craze is losing its luster because it's really not working the way they want it. Yeah, they're making a lot of money. But vouchers, all the craze. Because vouchers, that's a direct cash payment right to the rich people who are already sending their little darlings to private schools. And how are we going to pay for all that? Well, we're going to take from poor kids, of course, because we're pushing choice. We love choice. We love the idea of choice, or so we're told. And again, I come back to that choice between, you know, a bad one and a worse one. Those are your choices, sadly, because we've defunded a lot of public education. We've beat up and demonized teachers to the point where a lot of them are leaving the profession. It makes you wonder if the folks who are sitting on high, the Linda McMahons of the world, the Donald Trumps, the Elon Musks, if they really care about education. There's part of me that, and this is where the struggle is. There's part of me that looks at what they're doing as they don't see a future for the country as a whole because they've got AI. They don't need us as workers anymore. So they just need to dumb us down to the point where we're easily controlled. That seems to be the playbook here. As long as we don't know how bad we're getting screwed over, we won't rise up. You know, throw a little bread and circus out there. Some Cheetos and American Idol or whatever. And the more I look at this, the more I don't see their end game. We're going to return it to the states where we can get states competing on who does the worst job of educating their populace. Yeah. Or am I missing something here? Because they haven't come out with anything yet in all of this chaos that they've thrown out that actually benefits working people. Now, remember, they've told us they're the party of working people. In fact, they've told us over and over and over again how much they care, how concerned they are for the price of eggs, you know, price of gas. There was supposed to be, you know, a dozen eggs in every refrigerator and a gallon of gas in every tank. There was supposed to be all of that. And what are we getting? We're getting something all right. And what's frustrating is the collective outrage that's going on, I still think is pointed at the wrong stuff. We're following Trump instead of figuring out how to build the movement we're going to need to reclaim this country once they're done destroying it. Once the pain and the suffering happens, once the crisis occurs. I see people saying we're in the middle of a constitutional crisis right now. And yeah, I think we are. And if you look at what they're doing so far, what they've gotten away with so far, you got to wonder, will there be another election? And will we have to join our trifold hat, folks, in defending this nation from the oligarchs who now control it? I want to hear your thoughts. email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, I want to hear it. Download your podcast, freespeech.org. That's where you can see the video. And I want to hear from you, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks for being here. See you next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio.
WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. President Trump says he's revoking former President Biden's security clearance and ending the daily intelligence briefings. CBS's Olivia Rinaldi says the briefings are often offered as a courtesy.
Former presidents that are receiving it, we know, are former President Bill Clinton, George Bush, Barack Obama. So it's not unusual for a former president to receive those briefings, but it kind of continues a tit-for-tat started by President Biden back in 2021, where he said that President Trump could not receive any of these daily intelligence briefings.
The Justice Department agrees not to publicly reveal the names of FBI agents who worked on January 6th cases. CBS's Erica Brown on what President Trump has to say about agents.
Some FBI agents say they're worried they'll be fired for doing their job.
I'll fire some of them because some of them were corrupt. I have no doubt about that. We had some corrupt agents, and those people are